Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, September 10th, 2018. South Sudan aviation officials investigate the cause of a deadly plane crash over the weekend.
In the morning, usually there is evaporation of the water into the air. That's why it reduced the visibility, and that was the cause of the crash. But we don't base our reports or information on assumptions.
And President Kiir says South Sudan will pay China for building roads across the country.
I discussed with him the infrastructure in South Sudan, and we agreed that the road from Nadapal all the way to Torit and to Juba, again from Juba to Rumbek and to Wau.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The director of South Sudan's Civil Aviation Authority says poor visibility could have caused a plane crash in Eastern Lake on Sunday, killing 20 people and injuring 4 others. As Owaki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba, authorities have launched an investigation to find out what happened during the flight from Juba to Urol.
Captain Subek John, Chief Executive Officer of the Civil Aviation Authority, says Southwest Aviation chartered the 19-seat baby airline L410. He says the plane departed from Juba International Airport early Sunday morning and crashed into Lake Urol about 8:30 a.m. John says the Urol airstrip is suitable for flight operations, but says people and animals sometimes cross the airstrip, posing a danger to aircraft. He says documents he saw yesterday indicated that the L-410 was well-maintained. John says he was told it was extremely foggy in the area at the time the plane went down, but it's too early to determine the cause of yesterday's crash.
There was bad weather, because you know where it crashed actually is a lake, swampy area. So definitely in the morning usually there is evaporation of the water into the air. That's why it reduced the visibility, and that was the cause of the crash. But we as civil aviation, we don't base our reports or information on assumptions. But normally in the aircrafts, they are what we call black box. And that is where we form a committee to go and retrieve that black box. And that's where if the black box is sent to the factory for reading, that's when we shall get the exact concrete information on what caused the crash.
Eastern Lakes State Information Minister Taban Abel Agwek confirms it was foggy in Urol at the time of the crash. Captain John also notes that many flight companies often overload their planes with too many passengers.
I believe after this, we are going to be more serious and toughen our laws to be implemented by the airlines. Because what I learned, sometimes they do overload the plane, but now we are going to monitor them very closely to see to that they implement our regulation.
And John says some government officials have been known to pressure airline companies to allow their relatives or other officials to board flights that are already full to capacity, which endangers all passengers and crew.
I blame the companies. And there are some people whom, for example, if I'm a government official or what, but I have someone whom I want to travel, but because there is no, he was not booked in earlier, and because I'll be overusing or misusing my powers to make sure that my passenger or my relative goes.
In 2015, a cargo plane that was carrying passengers crashed into the banks of the River Nile in Juba, killing 37. Only a baby girl and an adult passenger survived the crash. Although the government investigated the 2015 crash, a report was never released explaining the cause of the accident. Officials stated then that preliminary findings indicated the plane was overloaded. The victims of yesterday's plane crash include the Anglican Bishop of Yirrol Diocese, identified as Right Reverend Simon Adut. Abel says a Ugandan and an Ethiopian national also perished in the crash, along with the women and children. According to a manifest obtained by South Sudan in Focus, 20 passengers were on board yesterday's flight. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
President Salva Kiir says he has reached a deal with the Chinese government to build more paved roads in South Sudan and pay China in crude oil. President Kiir says paying the Chinese government run companies in crude makes sense because it will save money that would otherwise be lost to corrupt officials if contracts were paid in cash. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
President Kiir decided to pay a visit to St. Theresa's Cathedral in Juba yesterday, where he briefed the congregation on his trip to Beijing last week to attend the China-Africa Cooperation Conference. Mr. Kiir says he and Chinese President Xi Jinping discussed the problems facing South Sudan and how China stands ready to help, especially with the road construction.
He knows that there is war in South Sudan, but he has some projects that he wants to execute in South Sudan. I discussed with him the infrastructure in South Sudan, and we agreed that the road from Nadapal all the way to Torit and to Juba, and again from Juba to Rumbek and to Wau.
Mr. Kiir defended his intention to pay Chinese companies with South Sudan's crude oil to avoid corruption, saying in Arabic, "Our people do not want to see money. If they see money, their hands will start to tremble."
We agreed on this, that they know South Sudan will not pay them any cash, but they will come with whatever they have from their money. They build the road, and we give them the crude oil from our oil here.
Separately today, the South Sudan government renewed its exploration production sharing agreement contract with a Malaysian oil company Petronas for another 6 years. The agreement permits the company to carry out oil production in blocks 1, 2 and 4 of the Thomas South oil fields in the former Unity State. South Sudan Petroleum Minister Ezekiel Lolgat-Quoth, who signed the contract on behalf of the government, says the environment will be protected.
The issue of the environment in the Republic of South Sudan is our number one priority in the Ministry of Petroleum. That's why in the agreement it is explicitly captured that the issue of decommissioning will be realized and a fund will be established to make sure that there is money for decommissioning. Because when we are carrying out oil operation, the environment will somehow be affected.
Katquoth also says the oil company has agreed to build tarmac roads in the oil fields rather than unpaved roads that easily wash away during heavy rains. He also says under the agreement, the government and Petronas will also set aside a community development fund.
We need to use oil to develop this country. We are also mindful of the community that are staying around the oil fields, that it's a fund that is directly meant for the community development in health, in roads, also in schools, in agriculture, in water.
Petronas Chief Executive Officer Datuk Mohamed Anwar says his company is committed to developing communities in oil-producing areas and building the capacity of South Sudanese nationals to run the oil sector.
We are looking forward to co-developing sustainable community-based programs for the people of South Sudan and contribute towards capability and nation-building. It is for this reason that more than 80 South Sudanese students have received Petronas University scholarships and more will come in the future.
Oil production in the former Unity State resumed last month for the first time since war broke out in December 2013. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
A South Sudanese church leader says he has received death threats from military officials in South Sudan. The Archbishop of the Internal Province of Bahr al-Ghazal, Reverend Moses Deng, says his recent Facebook postings about leadership in the country has landed him in trouble with certain government supporters who have threatened to kill him.
I say this, in my opinion, is what caused the first war, or the war which is still going on now, and it may actually cause the next war if it is not addressed. I then concluded by saying that it is my prayer and hope that with the current peace agreement, these reforms will be done to separate the army from the military and from the politics.
What was the reaction from people? I mean, you were telling me of certain people who replied you.
A lot of people have commented in very positively, but I had two people who actually threatened me. One told me to keep quiet before the sunset, and the other one advised him and said, "You keep let them speak, and one day each one of those bishops will carry his own cross," which is also meaning he will be killed. The first one who told me that I should keep quiet before the sunset went and wrote on his Facebook page, and he said, "You take up arms and come to fight for your agenda of a regime change." And I told him, "I do not even have a gun, but I have something more powerful than the gun, which is the truth."
But the people who are saying you have a pulpit, that is where you are supposed to communicate your messages, you are now going to Facebook. You are supposed to be preaching this in the church.
Well, but the Facebook is, what is the church? The church is where two or three people are gathered. And if there are two or three people on Facebook, that is the pulpit. That is the church. In fact, it is even better to preach on Facebook, because I can be able to preach to someone in Australia, in Kenya, in South Sudan, in Khartoum, in the government control areas, in the rebel control areas, in the refugee camp, everywhere. So I have found people on Facebook, and then I'm sharing the word of God with them on Facebook. And you know, there are television evangelists who preach on television, and they are using that as a pulpit as well.
And when are you going back to South Sudan? It's my understanding that you're speaking with me from Nairobi. When are you going back to South Sudan?
I am currently in Nairobi, and I'm going to South Sudan immediately after graduation. I want to attend graduation here in Nairobi at St. Paul, where I was doing a master's in development studies, specializing in peace building and conflict transformation.
Let's get back to your postings on Facebook. You picked an issue with South Sudan's first lady. Why are you specific about the first lady? You're saying that she was promoted to a general, and you know, why did you pick on the first lady?
Well, it's not only the first lady. That was, I think, was the misunderstanding of some of my friends. I was talking of mixing politics with army. And I just mentioned, because first lady is only one person, so I just mentioned, and I actually made the hierarchy of the government. So I started with the first lady, going into chief of his staff, to division commander, to brigadier, and all the other ranks. So it's just first lady came first because she's senior to the rest of the people that I'm talking about. But the point I'm making is that mixing politics with the military is the cause of the last war, because we know, or the first war, because we know it was disagreement within the party that went into the army. Whichever happened in the army, we don't know, as a civilian. But we know there was disagreement in the SPLM party, which affected the army. So I'm advocating and appealing to our leaders to separate the army from the politics.
That's Reverend Moses Deng, the Archbishop of the Internal Province of the Episcopal Church in Bahr El Ghazal area. He was speaking with me from Nairobi earlier today. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, aid agencies ask for more money to help people in South Sudan. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
have you ever bribed someone to get something? Why or why not?
No, I have not bribed someone before. And the reason is, I didn't want to push somebody to the wall to get something. The best thing, you have to do the right thing. So I have never bribed somebody in terms of getting something from the person, no.
Have I given bribe? Yes. Why did I give bribe? Because the system is wrong. Do I want to give bribe? No. Would I be able to get what I wanted if I didn't give him that money? No, I wouldn't have. So in a sense, I believe that bribery and corruption is not necessarily a personal desire. It's a systemic problem.
Personally, I don't think I've ever, but someone has done it for me, yeah, to get something I wanted. But personally, I have never bribed someone to get something.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, has raised concern over funding cuts affecting humanitarian agencies that provide assistance in South Sudan. Speaking to reporters in Nairobi recently, MSF warned of a massive humanitarian crisis if funding shortfalls continue to derail aid operations in South Sudan. VOA's Ruben Chama has the story from Nairobi.
The aid group said the humanitarian situation in South Sudan is worsening and urged the international community to continue providing aid for emergency response. Teresa Murray is Deputy Director of Operations from MSF Spain.
Vulnerable populations is that we have to scale up, and that's why the emergency gap is, that's the point of the emergency gap as well, to compensate pullouts, and that stretches us. Everything has its limits, and it's not only about funding, not just for us, but for other agencies. It's a human resource limitation also. Any funding cut in these types of contexts will always have an operational dilemma for us.
She told reporters in Nairobi that aid workers were facing a difficult time delivering medical supplies to some areas due to increased insecurity. This, she added, threatened the lives of many civilians, including displaced persons, women and children.
I think they're already food insecure, and there's exacerbating factors in South Sudan that will play onto the food insecurity, and non-access will exacerbate them further. So the cycle of food insecurity is diarrhea, waterborne diseases, malaria, and all of that translating into mortality. So no treatment, higher morbidity, higher mortality.
In July, South Sudanese authorities cancelled Independence Day celebrations for the third year in a row as its devastating civil war grinds on. It is now 7 years since the country gained independence from Sudan, but 5 years of fighting have killed tens of thousands and shattered the country's economy. Humanitarian groups say the many years of fighting have left the world's youngest nation with a dysfunctional healthcare system and some of the most tragic health indicators in Africa. According to MSF, infant mortality is at 60 children per 1,000 and maternal mortality is at 789 per 100,000. The WHO reports that dilapidated or destroyed structures have left 67 out of 80 counties with inadequate or no healthcare services at all. The conflict has further compromised the ability of the healthcare system to respond to the needs of the South Sudanese public in a number of ways. Exposed to extreme violence and living in fear for their lives, hundreds of thousands of people in South Sudan are not able to access basic necessities such as food, water, and healthcare. MSF spokesman Jairo Gonzalez says the most affected regions include Greater Upper Nile State in the northeast, as well as the equatorial region. He says malaria remains endemic and cases of pneumonia and waterborne diseases are on the rise, raising the possibility of preventable deaths unless urgent action is taken to reinforce access to treatment in the most high-risk areas.
At this moment, we're not talking about any specific outbreak in any of those diseases. I think malaria is endemic in South Sudan and goes with the rainy season. Now we're in the peak of the rainy season that will hopefully end in November. So it's yearly, the cases of malaria are on extreme in these months. But as I say, malaria, pneumonia, and diarrhea, this covers almost 80% of the morbidities in the country. That is very linked with the living conditions, poor access to water, poor shelter, and no access to health.
The South Sudanese Ministry of Health estimates that only 44% of the population has access to health services. South Sudan degenerated into civil war in 2013 after President Salva Kiir fell out with his then Vice President Riek Machar. Since then, tens of thousands of people have been killed in the fighting. Some 4 million people have also been displaced. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And now for some sports news. One South Sudanese Iyali Fellow, also known as the Mandela Washington Fellowship, says sports can unite various communities polarized by politics in South Sudan. Nasra Victoria manages the Nashvik initiative aimed at giving women new skills in South Sudan. Victoria, a soccer player, says South Sudanese women can do well in soccer if given a chance. She says her presence in the United States is paying off.
With numerous interactions with the different U.S. organizations, like the Grassroots Soccer Organization, it's an organization that supports youth through soccer, and they use soccer to run different initiatives like health promotion, education, and inter-clan reconciliations or interstate reconciliations or meetings. So with the organizational setup and the activities they run, if I go and implement using my initiative, which almost had the same objective or vision, I think we will be able with time to get rid of the tribal conflicts, because my initiative doesn't specify which tribe you come from for you to like be a member or to play football. I don't specifically deal with a specific team. I coordinate with the different teams.
But how do you get the teams? I mean, it starts from somewhere. How do you get a team? How do you identify a team before, that you want to work with?
Okay, before I came with this initiative, I joined a team in Juba. That's Butala FC. So I started playing with that team for almost a year, but given my work situation and my so many trips to the field, I couldn't really afford to keep training and playing. So I said, okay, with my passion for soccer, why can't I continue like uplifting these young girls or these young
stars? And what is your position in soccer? I played soccer many years back. What is your position?
I play number 11, which is wing, and I'm a left LFT. So when it comes,
so
to,
I am a lefty too.
So when I'm it comes to, when it comes to running, I run like an antelope. So just know how an antelope runs when it's being pursued by a lion. So that's me in the left.
And how many goals have you scored in your soccer career?
In my soccer career, I have so far scored good 30 goals. Good 30 goals from, like, when I really joined playing a real game, good 30 goals.
Mm-hmm.
We call them, some of them were virgin goals.
What is that? I mean, I've never heard that in soccer. What is virgin goal?
It's a goal that the keeper even couldn't manage to even have a small touch on the ball. That's what I termed it as, a virgin goal.
Okay.
Very clean and untapped ball.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about soccer in South Sudan. I know soccer is a sport that is male-dominated. During our time, I mean, we never had girls who could play soccer. I don't know. Things have changed. Are you facing any challenges in advancing that in South Sudan?
Even me, I faced those challenges when I was still coming up with soccer.
And what are
soccer.
These challenges? What I mean, when you get into the field, what do people tell you?
There are so many insults which come out from the spectators, and even before the spectators, right from home. It takes time for parents to understand that you really love soccer, or you're not trying to avoid something at home, doing something at home, to go and play football.
And with your group in Juba, teams that you're working with, what kind of empowerment techniques are you using to, if you like, attract young people to be interested in sports?
So far, of course, the initiative is still less than a year. We started in December. So, like, during this tournament, like, during the tournaments that I held, the tournament that I held, it drew much attention of girls who even stayed back at home. Then they realized that, indeed, there's good in football, or there's that beauty of being a player or a footballer. So many girls showed up and they really joined other teams, these other teams. Because if, like, right now, if I didn't even limit to 22, it would be more than 22 girls in a team that I want to directly work with. So there are more girls or more women who love football, but they're being held back by our social and cultural perceptions of the woman. For example, in one of the states, they say if you play football, you will not produce. And when we...
Meaning you will not give birth.
You will not give birth. Yeah, you will not give birth. And in actual sense, I really tried to think how football affects the reproductive system of the woman or of the female. And if it can make a woman not produce, why couldn't it make men not produce? That is the question I usually ask. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to, like, this year, use female footballers who already have families or children to speak out to the public that is a wrong, it's a myth. It's a myth that if you play football, you not produce.
That's Victoria Nasra, director of the NASVIC initiative, which empowers girls through sports in South Sudan. She was speaking with me here in our studio last week. That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song I Am Peace by a group calling itself I Am Peace Ambassadors.
I am the light shining bright in your eyes.
I am the voice whispering gently in your ear.
I am the hope that tomorrow is assured.
That forever we will stand side by side.
Anasalam,
salam.
Intersalam,
salam.
Anina salam,
salam.
I am peace, I am peace, I am.
Anasalam,
salam.
Intersalam,
salam.
Anina salam,
salam.
I am peace, I am peace, I am peace.
Mafi Sultan Badum Salam, Salam Yao Sultan Al Nesia. Kanita Bees Be Wajataku, Deyahu Salam. Salam Mabi Madam Fi Waraka, Salam Deti Fagia Fi Gulumna. Nabda Ibu Badu, Deyahu
Salam. Mabi Zira, Benu Salam. Mabi Giraya, Benu Salam.
This is not about signing the paper. This is not about hating each other. This is you, this is me, this is us. This is all about forgiving each other. Each other. Forgiving each other. Each other. Hey. Anasalam.
Salam,
intersalam,
salam,
anina
salam,
salam. I am peace, I am peace, I am peace.
From the moon to the sunrise, together we can shine bright. You and me, we can do love this nation. Kuzana, uita ya salam. Silama bijibu salam. Kila nina ya bijibu salam. Pen and paper ma bijibu salam. Kila kelba ya bijibu salam.
This is not a pen and a paper. This is not in Addis Ababa. This is in your heart. This is in my heart. This is in our hearts. We are peace.
It is all us to help us and make the world to know us. We got to do the best for the world to respect us. Drop the gun, stop the hate, we fight for peace. To make this country a better place for you, for me and for all of us. It is me, not any person but me and you, we can make it. It is the duty of community majority to bring the peace to our nation better than any other person.
You have been listening to a group of South Sudanese artists singing about peace. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Since peace is really the power,
I'm so ready. I wanna lay
you salam,
salam,
inta salam,
salam,
anina salam,
salam.
I am peace, I am
ana salam,
salam,
inta salam.